Stein Online's live Clubland Q&A is just 1 minute away.
This is Mark Stein, back after four sellout voyages for the fifth annual Mark Stein Cruise. If you like the sound of April in Portugal and Spain on the fabulous new ship, the Celebrity Apex, well, you'll be at the apex of celebrity for our traditional week of sun, sea, and civilizational collapse. I'll have special guests from both sides of the Atlantic, including a reunion of all your favourite telly presenters from the glory days of GB News, who've since been sacked. And we'll do all the things you like about the Mark Stein Show and Stein Online, but close up and on water. More details at steinonline.com or marksteincruise.com.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now. Here's Mark.
Hey, welcome along. March 5th, 2025. The year is going very quickly. It is 3 p.m. in Washington, D.C., where the last 24 hours have seen a modestly heartening decision from the D.C. Superior Court and a completely awful decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. 4 p.m. Do read Alito's dissent on that, by the way, because he was the only one, the Supreme Court decision, that is, he was the only one to take a really solid interest in my own case. He's the guy to watch rather than whatever her name is, Amy Coney, whatever. 4 p.m. in the beautiful... I shouldn't have interrupted the recitation of the time zones like that. It's all gone to hell now. 3 p.m. in North American Eastern Time, 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, where all three provinces are staying put in the deranged Dominion, unlike Alberta, where a delegation is en route to Washington to inquire about American statehood. 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland and beyond the Americas, 8 p.m. in Windsor, where the King and Queen have been joining Muslims in celebrating Ishtar at St. George's Chapel. No word on whether they'll also be celebrating Lent. 9 p.m. in Paris, the other capital city of the new Anglo-French Coalition of the Willing. 10 p.m. in Kiev, where Elizabeth Warren, as we know from last night, is looking forward to another 5 years of war. That was a brilliant moment if you missed the State of the Union. 11 p.m. on the Gaza Riviera, 11:30 p.m. in Tehran for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Iran out of solidarity with the half-hour time zone. 1:45 in Kathmandu for all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone. 4 a.m. in Singapore and Hong Kong, sorry about that. 7 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne, still kind of sorry. 9 a.m. in Auckland, and an even more civilized hour for the kippers and kedgeree in His Majesty's dominions across the Pacific. Happy Ash Wednesday to you. To our Cornish listeners, happy St. Piran's Day, the National Day of Cornwall. To our Azerbaijani listeners, happy Day of Physical Culture and Sport. Hope it's going gangbusters for you. Okay, let us get to your questions. We got some, I think we got some questions about the State of the Union coming up in a little bit. But we now have one from Eagle Patriot Minuteman, 1776. Who is also known as William of Kiev, because he was in Kiev until outbreak of war, when he was obliged to relocate west. We had him on the Mark Steyn show back when the war started, all those years ago, but not enough years for Elizabeth Warren, apparently. William of Kiev says, I'm happy to hear that your punitive damages have been lowered to $5,000. If you haven't yet heard, this was a decision made yesterday. So in other words, it got completely buried by the State of the Union, in which the $1 million that that nitwit jury in the District of Columbia had awarded to Michael E. Mann was reduced to $5,000. So he's lost $995,000. By the way, this is also relevant to the temporary restraining order crapola from this judge. Let me just say that I'll get back to William of Kiev's point in a minute. But this lousy, the district court judge in Dead Moose Junction, who, like all the district court judges in Dead Moose Junction, thinks that he can set national policy for the executive branch of the United States, ruled that the government of the United States, after this pause that the president of the United States, if you still remember what the president is supposed to be presiding over, the president had to cough up, he ordered him within 36 hours to cough up $2 billion as a temporary restraining order. A temporary restraining order is supposed to maintain, well, the clue is in the name, really. It's supposed to restrain temporarily. And as Alito pointed out in his dissent, once this $2 billion has been handed out to the various USAID recipients around this, so once it's been sent to Uzbekistan for the transgender ballet that you American taxpayers have been subsidizing, the chances of getting it back from them are zero. Once you've given it to the guy, getting it back is going to be extremely difficult. And this is true in this case. I fortunately had not yet. I was thinking about it. I was just on my way to the post office to ask for a very large Billy Bunter-sized postal order and give my $1 million to Michael E. Mann. What do you think the chances of me getting that $995,000 back from him? None. I mean, this is so. If Trump does wind up having to send the transgender ballet guys and the rest of them the $2 billion, chances of you, the American taxpayer, ever seeing any of that $2 billion again, so it's not a temporary restraining order. It's a permanent screw over for the American people. Anyway, that's just an aside. Let's get back to what William of Kiev was saying. I'm happy to hear that your he's not in Kiev anymore, by the way. He's in an American state. He says, I'm happy to hear that your punitive damages have been lowered from a million smackers to $5,000. Justice was as quick to arrive as the Durham Report, the Durham Report. But even $5,000 is too high for this issue. Mann had no damages he could have proven during discovery or during the initial filings of his and your pleadings. This case should have been dismissed immediately because there was no injury in fact. And even if there were damages, there is no way in hell that bald wanker Good. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. Now they'll put the $995,000 back on. There is no way in hell that bald wanker could have exceeded the $75,000 threshold to grant the crap DC Court of Appeals diversity jurisdiction. It certainly should not have survived summary judgment. Also, how the hell was DC the proper venue for all this? You're in New Hampshire, Michael Mann was in Pennsylvania, and the National Review is in New York. What kind of crap reasoning did the judge use to justify DC as the proper venue? Well, yeah, he didn't. He is now. Somewhere in his decision, his judgment, which we posted at Stein Online, but somewhere he does actually refer to the fact that neither I nor Mann nor Rand Simberg, my co-defendant, none of us live in the District of Columbia. It's a complete waste, aside from anything else, it's a complete waste of the District of Columbia's time. And he does point, and it is very weird that, but they you can do venue shopping in America, and they venue shopped very cleverly, man, and whoever his sugar daddy is. What kind of crap reason do you use to justify DC as a proper venue? Is there something to this I do not know about? The judge has as much sense as Michael Mann has hair. I've never met a more arrogant bunch of horses' asses than judges. I had this idiot federal judge try telling me how wonderful diversity is. Me of all people. Diversity led to me being blown out of the place where I lived, and I told that idiot that much. Imagine his shock when a first-year law student told him how stupid he is. To him, diversity is queer on one corner of his block and a token black guy who is whiter than I am on the other end of the block. These out-of-touch morons and dinosaurs live in another universe. You know, as I understand it, the fact that he had no damages, the judge kept bringing up all through the last, well, since he was appointed, I guess, because this guy's the sixth trial judge. He must be coming to the end soon, and then we'll get the seventh trial judge. Because Mann's appealing to, I'll go into that in a bit. But anyway, so the sixth trial judge, he kept saying, well, you've got to, come on, man, you've got to show some damages. And John Williams, the arse who is Michael E. Mann's lawyer, or actually he acts for Michael E. Mann, but he's being lavishly funded by whoever the sugar daddy is, kept saying, oh, well, there's no, we don't, are under no obligation to disclose our damage case until we get to trial, which I've heard before. I had the same thing with the cockwomble Carrie Katz in Nevada and New York and wherever, that he didn't have to disclose his damages, and he didn't have any damages either. I mean, this seems to be quite a common thing. Perhaps Chief Justice Roberts would at one point like to take a look at that. The habit of the courts being clogged up by people who don't have any damages but insist that they're not obligated to disclose their damage case until they actually get to trial. But we shouldn't underestimate. That annoyed the judge. For example, Mann is now appealing to get National Review and Competitive Enterprise Institute, who were dismissed from the case, to get them back into the case because they've got the big bucks, supposedly. But that's why yesterday's ruling, reducing the $1 million that the jury decided to give him from me, to $5,000. That's why it's so big. Just to put it in perspective, the most he can recover now is $6,002 from me and Simberg. Now, I know in most countries of the world, if you listen, oh, $6,002. Holy smokes, that's a big stack of greenbacks. Yeah, it would be in normal countries, but it's nothing here. Just to put it in perspective, that's less than Mann has had to pay CEI. He He was found to have breached some discovery rule by, I think it was the third or fourth trial judge, might have been the fifth trial judge, but it was a couple of trial judges ago. And he was ordered to pay CEI $9,000, Michael E. Mann. So in other words, he's won, quote unquote, $6,002, which is less than he had to pay CEI in just one discovery infraction that happened to annoy the judge. So that's his maximum. He can't get any more from me under this ruling. It's not appealable. So it's so I owe him $5,001, supposedly, and Rand Simberg owes him $1,001. That's $6,002. He already owes over $500,000 to National Review that the judge ordered him to pay and which he's failed to pay. He's going to have another $500,000 plus to pay CEI when they file their costs motion against Michael E. Mann. So he's won, quote unquote, $6,002, and he's lost over $1 million plus the $9,000. And plus. So the question is whichever sugar daddy is paying for this? Because as he testified at trial, he hasn't paid a dime in legal expenses. Whether the sugar daddy is George Soros or whether it is USAID via some cutout, which means it's you, the taxpayers, who are serving as Michael E. Mann's sugar daddy. The question is whether they're willing to carry on paying for something that's going nowhere. That is in a corrupt jurisdiction with possibly the worst. I did this. If you look up the speech I gave to Hillsdale, I think it was 5 or 6 months ago, and I was comparing the percentage of voters in the District of Columbia who vote for Joe Biden compared with the percentage of voters who voted for Saddam Hussein and Hosni Mubarak and Kim Jong-un and various other. And that's basically what we're talking about. We're talking 90-something percent of voters voted for Joe Biden. So when it comes to an issue where a conservative is the defendant, basically you're dealing with a jury pool that is 11 of them are hardcore Democrats, and the 12th juror is a member of the Socialist Workers' Party. That's what you're dealing with in D.C. And I couldn't get over the way. Phelim McAleer actually made this point to me. Phelim is famously Irish, but he's from Northern Ireland. So when he has to go to court, they're British courts, which, you know, they're United Kingdom courts, which he's not particularly a fan of. But he was aghast at this practice in the day. You turn up, you get out, oh, what am I doing? Oh, God, I'm supposed to be at the courthouse. So you have a shower and you climb into your suit and you get all your papers together and you hustle yourself over to the courthouse to find you got to hang around for an hour to see whether the last juror shows up so they'll have sufficient to proceed with the trial. Just extraordinary. Just world's most worthless. I'd have been better off taking my chances with Saddam Hussein's jury pool or Hosni Mubarak's jury pool. These are ridiculous things. Yes, William is quite right. He had, and yes, you're quite right on your larger point that American judges are not terribly impressive. As I think I mentioned last week, I had one in one of the arbitration things. I had one terrific arbitrator who I would rather have seen, and I thought about this at the time Amy Phoney Barrett was going through her the Senate confirmation bollocks. I thought I'd much rather have had, and he was, as far as I could tell, a Democrat. But the thing about it, he had a forensically legal mind as opposed to this finger in the, you know. And by the way, this judgment today from Roberts, the Chief Justice, his whole thing, we did a segment on this, me and Shannon Bream, when I was doing whatever that 7 o'clock show was on Fox. And Shannon's point is always that the Chief Justice doesn't want the court dragged into all this, you know, daily churn of politics, because he thinks that's something that should be left to the political process. But I said to Shannon, there comes a point when the desire to avoid controversy becomes itself controversial. And I think that's the point we're at this time. Basically, the judiciary has teamed up with the permanent bureaucracy to screw over the people that the voters actually voted to run things. So it's an assault on responsible government. It's an assault on the very possibility of a republic. To quote another old line of mine, as I said to Tucker all those years ago, at the time of the Amy Phoney Barrett confirmation, I said a judge's republic is a contradiction in terms, and that's what we saw today. Drew Weber says, hello, Mark. Good to see the judge reduce the punitive damages, although seems the judge miscalculated the treble for punitive damages, resulting in 2 extra 0. I think the Supreme Court has said it can't be more than 9 times the actual damages. So the actual damages were $1. So in theory, the punitive damages shouldn't be more than $9. So I've got a choice of whether I should go to back to court. And you'd have to take it to the Supreme Court, because the appellate court in D.C. is one of the crappiest, even by the standards of crap courthouses, is one of the crappiest the country. So you're not going to get anything there. So you're going to have to then be prepared to take it all the way up to Alito and Phoney Barrett and the rest of the gang. So you'd have to spend $4 million to get a ruling that you don't have to pay the 50 grand, just $9. I mean, the thing about it is, you know, the not having to pay the million is a huge relief. If you've seen, I saw Peter Navarro when I gave that speech I was talking about a couple of minutes ago. And he was completely screwed over by these dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt courts. Rudy Giuliani has. And I like the way there are a lot of what I think of as naive sophisticates out there. You know, they're people who know enough to have heard all the things that people say. So people, when Rudy Giuliani got that thing, got that ruling against him, I had all these people say, oh, you don't need to worry about Rudy. He'll have put everything in his girlfriend's name or in his kid's name or whatever. And you think, oh, yeah. And what do you know? 2 weeks later, there's the guys show up to take his car. You can't. I think that's terrible to do that to Rudy Giuliani at his age, to take everything he has, and to, as we learned during the business of Trump in that corrupt New York courthouse, where they ordered him to pay $500 million. They pulled that law out of their asses in New York and said he had to pay $500 million. Well, to appeal that, everyone, and then all the naive sophisticates say, well, of course, in America, we have this thing called an appellate process, and I've no doubt that Trump will win on appeal. Yeah, well, you have to be able to bond what you owe before you're allowed to appeal. Again, I did this on the show, I think it was last year. I think I said, I mentioned it, that I'd just checked the constitutions of all the countries we went through in the British West Indies on on the last year's Mark Steyn cruise. And they all had things like, if it's up to $20,000, I think it is, you have to bond it, but not when it's above that. So Trump has to find a bond for $500 million. Do you know how many people on the planet would be willing to bond, would be able to bond, put up a bond for $500 million? So the problem, you know, I don't even, because as I as I said to one of my many, I think this came up just after my heart attack, when I really didn't need the heart attacks, I didn't need the additional stress. And I was supposed to be going to trial. The doctors didn't want me, said I wasn't well enough to live. I was in France, just got out of the ICU. And the judge said, no, the trial's going ahead on schedule. And the money had run out. And I was thinking about these things because basically the French medical system saved my life for €4,500, which I thought very reasonable. And certainly when compared with the costs of litigation in the District of Columbia. And the money had run out. And so one of the lawyers said, well, have you got some possessions you could sell? And I said, I'm in the post-possession phase of my life, which is more or less true. So not having this $1 million, not having to hear there's a bit of a loud sound, banging sound in the morning, and I wake up and draw the curtains, and there's Michael E. Mann confiscating my car. That's a great relief. As I said, this awful, awful, corrupt grifter, it will get, if he gets everything he's supposedly owed by Rand Sinberg and me, he'll get $6,002, which is $3,000 less than what he had to pay CEI for ignoring that discovery motion. He's got over $1 million plus to pay National Review and CEI. So he's got to find a sugar daddy now. And I don't know, his big thing is to try now and get his whole argument. He filed a motion saying why he shouldn't have to pay National Review, his argument being that National Review would most likely have to wind up paying what I owed him, that $1 million. So that hasn't worked out. So the argument that no, I shouldn't have to pay National Review because they'll probably be paying, having to pay for the $5,000 that Steyn owes me, that isn't going to work out either. And I do get the judges won't disturb a jury's core finding, but if you do read what that judge wrote, there isn't a lot of good news for Michael E. Mann in it. Anyway, so there we are. Chris Davis writes from London. Chris threw me an absolutely lovely party at his club in London after my day in the English High Court. And that was very, and for a lot of other people, friends of the Steyn Show, for Leilani Dowding, and for Samantha Smith, and for all your favourite guests on the Mark Steyn Show, threw a lovely, lovely party for all of us, and for a lot of supporters who'd flown in from all over the British Isles and from the continent too. I think we had some couple of people from Toronto there as well. It was a lovely party. And Chris says, Mark, I hope you're well. Congratulations on the Michael Mann result. The wheels of justice have turned slowly, but hopefully that bloody nose will knock the wind out of the hockey stick blowhard. 44 days into Trump's comeback, and he is maintaining a relentless pace. How impressive was his swatting of Zelensky, despite the opprobrium of the globalist community and chattering classes? Do you think world leaders will finally understand now that America First and MAGA means what it says on the tin? Keep well, Mark. Well, I tell you this, that the world leaders do understand that. They're existing, though. You know, that's why Starmer's whole thing now is that, oh, I can be the bridge between Europe and Trump. You know, Trump doesn't really need you as a bridge. and then we have Zelensky. Basically, Zelensky has folded. He's because Trump cut off the military aid. You know, the thing is that if you think about how diplomacy is conducted, you know, so whatever the reaction was, when all those Hamas parachuted in and raped and murdered all the peaceniks at that hippy-dippy music festival. You know, and the diplomatic response is that, we view with grave concern recent developments in the Israeli-Palestine situation. You know, that's the way you're meant to do it. You issue a strong statement. Trump doesn't do that. Trump imposes tariffs, and so Panama backs down and Mexico backs down, and he cuts off military aid, so Zelensky backs down. You know, where has it gotten us? You know, if you think back to when all this, we view with the utmost concern, the League of Nations was started at the end of the Great War. So whatever that is now, 100 plus years ago. And it was well understood that whatever, yes, you might admit this or that country into it, but that it was going to be the great powers who controlled things. And in those days, and in fact at the time the United Nations was set up after the Second World War, one continent, Europe, owned an entire other continent, Africa. So the idea that you could talk in this agreed language was much more widely accepted. When you use that, well, we view with grave concern, when you're using that to describe people who hold a parade of dead babies, and then the citizens cheer the babies you've murdered, when you're in that kind of world, this early 20th century view of the Parliament of Man doesn't really work at all. And that's why Trump is necessary. Just to bring it back to what Chris's core point is, I haven't seen any alternatives to doing it Trump's way. Now, we saw with this State of the Union, these initial polls all showed 70-75% of people watching thought it was, as I said, a corker. They liked it. So where the Democrats are going wrong is basically people who are a bit squeamish about the mean tweets have gotten over that. And Trump's numbers now, where he just is doing things, and as opposed to just tweeting about things, he's just doing things, and they like what he's doing. Now, it doesn't work over in Europe. I noticed there's a lot of supposedly conservative publications, which aren't really conservative in any way, but like my old friends at The Spectator and The Telegraph are saying that, they're worried that Nigel's closeness, quote-unquote, Nigel's closeness to Trump is going to cause problems for. It'll put a ceiling because they've noticed that now Labour have overtaken Nigel again and all the rest of it. The thing is, at one point, even a useless British or continental tosspot has to come up with an alternative. That's to say, okay, the Trumpy stuff, when we're still, we don't like the bad orange man and all that. Okay, well, what do you got? What have you got instead? Because Trump is out there every day doing stuff. And all that seems to happen in Europe is that a so-called conservative wins, or so-called populist wins the election, and then all the other parties team up to prevent him from doing anything. So you're going to have to... the Trump right now, if you don't like the uniparty consensus in the Western world, only Trump has come up with a way to bust through that. And at some point, so if the sophisticated Europeans say this and say that, well, okay, but you're going to have to come up with somebody who can do it. Denise O'Leary writes, Mark, is it possible that Dems are courting splinter party status? At the rate that they are taking positions opposed by the vast majority of Americans, that is their natural destiny. How much longer before an enterprising left-of-centre coalition threatens to start a new party that drops the lunatic elements of the Dem platform and starts harvesting scads of wine mom votes? Most suburban wine moms who hate Trump are probably not Transhausen moms, right? And as soccer moms, they don't want their daughters' orthodontics shattered by a dude named Alice. Why are the Dems sacrificing so much for so little? I don't ask you to make it make sense, but I know of no one better to come up with a coherent account of their point of view. Well, the problem for them, as we saw last night, is they're on the wrong side of a lot of 80-20 issues. Now, the way it works is you've got committed ideologues on the right and committed ideologues on the left. Then you've got a huge amount of the oblivious people, which is a big thing. Particularly in America, people who, you know, they don't want to hear about public policy because they're too busy taking an interest in Kim Kardashian or whatever. And I apologize if Kim Kardashian is last year's thing and it's somebody else now. But that's the point. They don't have to have an interest in these. It's not about, you know, these people as individuals. It's just the culture of oblivion that these people are maintained in, which is very like Aldous Huxley and Brave New World. Then you've got the so-called normies, which is not a term I particularly like, but these are people who they're nice, respectable people who like to think of themselves as informed about current affairs. But most of the bollocks issues you can present in terms that will make them feel as if in order to be nice and progressive and get on with their neighbours, they need to take the Democrat side on it. Like Ukraine. Who cares about Ukraine? I don't know. Yeah, Ukraine. Oh, yeah, I was so upset when I heard that there was a war going on in Ukraine. Yeah, I don't really know where it is. I think, is it in Europe or is it after that? And I always get a bit, after Austria, it all gets a bit vague to me where these countries are. But they seem nice. And I like the way that guy walks around in a figure-hugging sweater. It reminds me of my dad when he used to watch Lana Turner movies. And so, yeah, I found out what flag they had, and I put it on my Twitter feed. And it's very difficult to... Those are the issues. And that's why the trans thing... Ava Vladingerbroek, before the last year's election campaign, pointed out that with her Dutch friends, progressives, It was the one thing that you could get through to people on. And so, for some reason, the Democrats dug in on it. And again, it might have been possible if it was like old school trannies, when we used to call them transsexuals, because they had to have that special operation. What was it? Rush had a promo for it. What was it called? He called it on a chop a dick off of me. That was the operation you had to have. And that was a great Rush promo. I'd love to hear that again, actually. And the thing about that is, you know, that's a serious business. Kathy Schadl, in the last conversation I had with Kathy, sitting at her bedside, Kathy always called them mentally ill, mentally ill castration fetishists. The thing about that, though, is it's a serious business, right? If you're going to all that trouble, I mean, particularly men, if you think about it, you're so keen on this thing that you're going to have all your bits removed. That's serious business. And at that point, people are reducing, it's chromosomes, you know, you can't do this. It's all, you're not changing sex. It's all chromosomes. Well, most people wouldn't know a chromosome if it fell off a tree and hit them in the head. But the thing they do understand, they do get, because it couldn't be any clearer, is if there's a penis in their daughter's changing room. People get that. It's actually one of those stark, clarifying moments. So you can't say, oh, he must really be keen on this. If he went to the trouble of having all his bits removed. We discussed this again on the Mark Stein. I don't like to do the, as I said, 10 years ago, 20 years ago thing all the time. But years ago on the Mark Stein show, I said that this lowered the bar of entry. If you don't have to have anything chopped off, and you just think it might be fun to wander around showing your wedding tackle in the ladies' changing room, it's perfect. So it's the most, and this is really, the problem is we live in a world where the Democrats' ideas are the default setting. USAID, it sounds so nice. I think it's going to help starving Africans. Is that right? I'd love to help starving Africans. And even when you're told that millions and millions of dollars are going to Bill Kristol, the Never Trumper, who isn't starving and isn't African. Yes, but I mean, generally, it's going to starving Africans, isn't it? I mean, after Bill Kristol has taken away enough of the millions to fund his lifestyle, or Stacey Abrams has taken that $2 billion for an entity that does nothing, there'll still be $17.87 that will be going to starving Africans, won't there? And it's all the default setting of our society is on the Democrat side. But a penis in your daughter's changing room is hard to swallow. And that's basically what the Democrats did. So Trump's genius is, and they, again, they had a chance to say, yeah, you're right, we don't want all the guys who are hung like stallions beating our daughters up in school sports. They wouldn't take it. They voted now. The same people who wear the stupid pink pussy hats voted for penises in your daughter's locker room. It's incredible. Now, the only question is, could they create the, they control all the media, they control all the courts, could they create the conditions whereby a supposedly free people accept that their boys are going to be turned into girls and their girls are going to be turned into boys? And that's, at least in some states, an open question. But it goes to show, it's like, it's the most obvious thing. And that's why it's so disastrous for Democrats. But it's it also shows you how far you have to go before you can get all these. The problem with all the trans stuff, which is child abuse, which is bodily mutilation, which does irreversible damage, which, oh, your little girl wants to be a boy. Well, we're going to experiment on her body so that when the madness passes and in 2-3 years' time she decides to be a nice little girl again, she'll have no breasts and she'll be infertile. These people actually, I say this more and more often about more and more things, but these people should be hanging from lampposts. But it's all the nice people. You know, what's evil about the monopoly on education is it's not, you know, sexually ambiguous types with green hair who are doing this. It's nice little 54-year-old ladies at your local grade school who are in favour of this. That's how far it's got. But for the moment, the idea, I mean, that's why when people used to, when I'd talk about this on Rush, when it all started, and people say, oh, this is just happening to 7 people, you shouldn't be talking about this. No. The point is, it shows the scale of the Democrats' ambition, that they wish to erase biological sex, and they have persuaded most of officialdom to go along with it until Trump came along. And you have 2 parties in America, and 1 party is all on board with the abolition of biological sex. And it's Trump's brilliant ad in which he said, I'm for you, and Kamala is for they, them. They introduced this into the public discourse, and it's become, for people who think, you know, for people who will go along with the Ukraine rubbish or whatever, this is the one thing that makes them think, hang on a minute, where's all this going to end up? I find it disturbing because, particularly when you look at all the celebrities, like the woman from Sex and the City who was saying the other day, well, yes, it's so beautiful, isn't it? My daughter or son or whatever he or she currently is trans, and his or her best friend is trans, and the uncle of the best friend is trans, and they're trying to make that, and the only thing that stops it is, oh yeah, my 9-year-old daughter said there were 3 girls with penises in the showers today. You know, this is what that's how bad it's got, that you need something as stark as that for so-called normies to think, well, maybe this isn't quite as normy as I think it was. This is Slide Online's Clubland Q&A live around the planet. Oh, this is the favourite part of the show. Everybody loves this show because Mark Stein is here. Remember him? Mark Stein is here to tell you all about our weekend music show. This is Mark Stein. On the Town this week, songs across the century, songs around the world, from the continent and from the Commonwealth, plus a cavalcade of non-stop number ones down the decades. And Frank Sinatra, country and western style, on the Town, Saturday at 5 on Serenade Radio. Yeah, and Saturday at 5 p.m. London time, that is, which is 6 p.m. in Western Europe or 12 midday North American Eastern. Mark Stein live around the planet. It is 13 to 4 Eastern time. That means it's 13 to 9 Greenwich Mean Time. A little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent earth. David says, Mark, I also thought Trump's speech last night was a corker. Does anyone in America say corker? I remember, I don't think I said it a lot after I came to America, but I remember I used to say it a lot beforehand. Anyway, If it's not American, I'm introducing it, so deal with it. He basically called out the Dems before he even started the actual speech, and they obliged him to a T. Apparently, the Democratic Party playbook is titled How to Lose Voters and Influence No One. Trump made... The thing is, it's all old. You know, everything they did. The wearing pink. It's kind of lame, isn't it? Don't you think? And they're holding up the little, whatever they were meant to be, the ping pong bats with things written on them. It's a little lame, don't you think? You know, it didn't get you anywhere. The resistance is over. You know, because you haven't, the resistance is out of ideas. I mean, that's where it didn't get anywhere. I made the case, I'm sorry, I got a bit of a problem with my voice today. Trump made pretty solid cases, said David, for his policy decisions, with the exception of one. I'm trying to figure out why he has tied Canada to Mexico as the target of punitive tariffs. I get that he detests Justin Castro as a fraud and a poser and a punk. But his reasoning keeps shifting, and it is not a secret that the immigration and drug control problems the USA has is predominantly, and way so, coming from the southern border. This seems to be something the markets and American citizens will regret. What say you? Well, in the long term, he has got a security issue with Canada. I mean, he's thinking, he's not just randomly sticking pins in the map. He doesn't feel China should be controlling the Panama Canal. And he did something about it. And likewise with Mexico and likewise with Greenland. These are all places he feels are central to his conception of what is necessary for U.S. preeminence and regional security. For example, Canada has been hollowed out by Chinese corruption, and he doesn't want that on the northern border. Now, you say quite rightly that the immigration and drug problems are predominantly from the southern border. But the southern border in the United States goes all the way up to the northern border, basically, these days. If you look at, where MS-13 operates, you know, MS-13 is Latin American gangs. But they're in Long Island, they're in Massachusetts, you know, they're within sight of the northern border. And what do they do when they get up there? Well, they make arrangements that involve a lot of drugs coming across the northern border, a lot of terror. I mean, the interesting thing I find, I live just shy of the Quebec border, which was important to me because I always thought I had that immigrants thing that if the whole powder keg goes up in America, I always wanted to just be able to hop in the car and be across the border before anyone. I could just go to the bank, clear out my checking account, get across the border with enough money to be able to afford a cheap motel in Quebec. And now the nature of that border has changed. They apprehend terrorists at that border. They apprehend drug dealers at that border. The whole scale. So from that, and yes, it's not as bad as the southern border yet, but it's not good. Canada is changing. They used to call the 49th parallel the world's longest undefended frontier, because we were basically dealing with two large chunks of territory that had taken a different view of what happened in 1776. The difference now is, and you can, Canada could certainly make the case vis-a-vis America, but you have two countries that What was the old joke? Some guy, and they thought it was brilliantly clever. I was given a book about this as a kid, about the longest undefended frontier in the world. Oh, what's the difference between Dominion Day and Independence Day? Oh, about 48 hours. Because the point being that these were two countries that had a great deal in common. Well, they have less in common now. And for that, Trump is figuring out that it's going to pose certain challenges in the years ahead. And there are different views on that. You know, it was very clear after 9/11, for example, whether the correct position for Canada was to be inside a North American perimeter or outside a US perimeter. And in the end, it didn't make any difference because governments of the United States were not particularly serious. So there was no US perimeter and people could just walk into the country. But we're in a... There is no Western world anymore. The idea of a unified West is basically a 1950 idea that is falling apart. Now, if you look at Pierre, people have said, why is Trump doing this? The conservatives were roaring ahead, and now the liberals are within 2 points of them or whatever. Well, look at it from Trump's point of view. Pierre Poilievre, for example... He was complaining the other day that Pierre Poilievre isn't very nice to him, as he puts it. And that's been true since long before the tariffs were announced. That because on the same grounds as the Telegraph is rebuking Nigel for being too close to Trump. So you've got what are supposed to be your closest allies. We're not talking about, you know, foreign language type countries. We're talking about two great allies from D-Day, Britain and Canada, where the Conservatives keep their big emphasis is, you know, oh, well, no, we're not like Trump. Even in the Apple, the thing about the apple chomping moment for Poilievre was that it was... He was responding brilliantly, nonchalantly, apple-crunchingly to some twit who kept trying to tie him to Trump. The thing about that is, from Trump's point of view, it's because he's the only guy who's making a difference. If you do want another 5 years of war in Ukraine, then fine, keep doing your thing with Zelensky and all the rest of it. Something is changed. We are coming to the end. This is something I wrote about in After America a decade ago or whatever it is now. But we're coming to the end of the 1950 moment, and the blocks are shifting and reshaping. And Justin decided, you know, he was going to... That would have been a European summit had on the weekend, had Justin not decided to fly in for it. These are... There has to be a way for so-called concerns. We had the Stephen Harper ministry, which didn't affect... I gave a speech in Ottawa at the time. I think actually Laureen Harper was actually there for it. You know, you can't have conservative government in a liberal culture, was the theme of the speech. And so you have to have, you have these go along to get along conservative governments in Australia, in Canada, in Britain, in Europe. And Trump's not wrong to want something more than that from these people. So I don't know why if the idea is that, oh, everybody's going to vote for Mark Carney, the former governor of the Bank of England, the former governor of the Bank of Canada, who is Mr. Net Zero, Mr. Project Fair, and all the rest of it. If there are these people, if the so-called normies, you know, which is what it's about, It's shifting enough of these normies to prevent yourself going over the cliff. And that's, you know, there are issues with that. Jeff Estes says, "Hi, Mark. I believe Trump's sprint to tariffs was related to China's influence over Canada, Mexico and Panamanian politicians. Do you think Canada will replace Castro with another Chinese stooge? If so, who?" I talked about Chrystia Freeland last week, and I've talked about Mark Carney. These people are jokes, objectively. They're not going to, for example, to save Canada and to save the British Isles and save Europe, you're going to need remigration. Otherwise, though, as in Canada, the Muslim population by 2020 was four times larger than what it was at 9/11. So people say, well, wait a minute, 9/11. So at the same time as Mohammed Atta was on that plane flying into the World Trade Center. So at the same time now, we decided to quadruple to double the rate of Muslim immigration to the West. That's why, that's a much better conspiracy theory than all the stuff about does fire melt World Trade Center Tower 7. Why the reaction to, and again, I'm not even talking about the statistics 5 years later. The reflex thing to say, Islam is a religion. Nobody said, did FDR after Pearl Harbor suddenly feel the need to say, Japan is the empire of peace? Or no, the whole way, and I don't want to get into a lot of FDR conspiracies, but the thing about it is, to look at what is the actual effect of something. That is what America alone was principally about. It was saying, look, the most important question, which used to be a journalism question, used to have people like Dick Morris was interested in my book because Dick Morris is interested in demography. And he was interested in demography because he shows that, in this particular swing district in Ohio, so many soccer moms have now moved into it that it used to be reliably red, but it's now a bit purple. And who knows where it'll be in 5 years' time. We do all this super granular stuff on this or that district, but we don't apply the logic of demography to the big picture, which is that if you want your children to be Muslim, then keep voting for what's he called, Fred Mertz in Germany, because he's not going to do anything to stop that. And this is about as basic as it gets. And so trying to find a cigarette paper's worth of difference between the uniparty candidates, this is all irrelevant. What's needed, if you believe in responsible government, democratic government, self-government, whatever you want to call it, then it doesn't work if nobody ever talks about anything that matters. So the fact that Birmingham in England is a third Muslim now, you can't talk about that because the Labour government's priority is to pass some Islamophobia legislation. You have a situation where when Muslims make the news in the UK, it's mostly because they're raping and stabbing little girls. Even as an uncovered story, you know, if you know how to decode your local paper, or if you do the French thing where they won't even publish the names, so it's just the first name, and you have to. Oh, some guy got stabbed there. What was he called? Oh, Lucien Flavien. But he got stabbed to death. Oh yeah, who stabbed him to death? Oh, we don't know. We only just know his first name. It's Mohammed or Ahmed. Ahmed. None of that's an obstacle to the king and queen celebrating what's it called, Ishtar. One of them's the crappy film with is it Warren Beatty, and the other's the Muslim Ramadama Ding Dong thing, but the king and queen, even after the guy who stabbed those little girls had the Al-Qaeda handbook. Oh, yes, the important thing is for the king and queen to celebrate Ramadan at Windsor Castle. It's awful. It's going to take revolution. Unless you can talk, politics doesn't matter if politics never talks about anything that matters. And that's the other great thing about Trump. You know, now, whatever you feel about it, you know, so, well, wait a minute, why is he picking a fight with Denmark over Greenland? Oh, well, you know, because he feels that Greenland isn't, the interests of the United States aren't being served by the present Danish sovereignty. These are points, you know, they're not the bollocks, which is what most of it is. It's not the Tories and trivia stuff that you get on GB News. There's a rumour that the Lord Privy Seal might be about to be fired. I wonder who's going to be the next Lord Privy Seal. Your country's becoming a semi-Islamic dump. Why don't you talk about that? That'd be worth talking about. It's very sad, a lot of this stuff. Xi Jinping, possibly not the real name, says, since the European-based NATO nations have relatively low military staffing levels and budgets, I would find it interesting if Starmer, Macron et al. Would start publicly suggesting implementation of the draft before indicating their willingness to put boots anywhere near Ukraine. Then we all would see how their populations really feel about Ukraine. No, because the way you demonstrate your support for Ukraine, like the Portuguese Prime Minister, he said, we will always support Ukraine. I think he's got 7 tanks. So that guy could. What do you mean? Well, these people are. The whole. It formally began when. Do you remember that thing about the girls who'd been kidnapped by Boko Haram? In Africa, was it in Nigeria? And Michelle Obama held up a piece of cardboard with hashtag bring back our girls on. And then David Cameron, he also got a piece of cardboard with hashtag bring back our girls on. I always thought hashtags were something to do with computers. I didn't even realize that you could do them on cardboard. And that they'd work just as well. So that was new for me. I learned something there from Michelle Obama and David Cameron. But this idea, now they're not wrong to this degree. I'm not in favor, just to be clear here, I'm not in favor of American boots on the ground in Ukraine. I don't want any American boots anywhere until Pete Hegseth has cleaned out that disgusting den of beribboned buffoons in the Pentagon, because America has a lot of boots to put on the ground, but America also loses wars. I mean, one of the interesting things about Trump's State of the Union speech was getting this guy responsible for the Abbey Gate bombings in Kabul. At a time when thoroughly modern Millies, his thing was to drone the 7 most photogenic Moppets in Afghanistan on the way out the door. The Pentagon and the US military needs rebuilding from top to toe. So there shouldn't be American boots on the ground. Now, this idea, why aren't there European boots? The Prime Minister of Poland, Donald Tusk, who's not a guy I like at all, but he had a very good point. He said, why are 500 million Europeans asking 300 Americans to protect them from 140 million Russians, right? They can have the 500 million Europeans are enormously wealthy by the standards of anywhere else. So they can afford to defend themselves. And if they had believed their own bollocks 3 years ago about Ukraine or about Russia and the threat it posed, this is like Chamberlain 3 years into the war suddenly calling a cabinet meeting and saying, tell you what, chaps, do you think maybe I should go out and give a speech about saying how it might be time for us to expand weapons production? The war's been going on for 3 years now. Do you think it might be time to say something? It comes from this shadow play, this stupid, you know, where politics is about just palace intrigue and gossip and other. It's just rubbish, all of it. It's just a lot of rubbish. And I'm sorry here, I'm losing my voice a bit. Jean Basson, or Jean Basson. Is it Jean or is it Jean? I don't know. Jean Basson. Respectfully, though, it's not really doubling down on the loser stuff. That's what I said about the Democrats last night. They're very unattractive, though. It's a reasonable calculation based on recent history. In 2010, the left pushed, pulled, and towed Obamacare across the finish line. They were whipped in the midterms that year, but doubled down on the loser stuff. Well, I said that, actually, at the time. They made a bet that they'd have to have a timeout, but that the Republicans would not have the will to repeal Obamacare. 8 years later, says Jean Basson, or Jean Basson, they picked up where they left off and started impeaching three times a week. The calculation here is simple. The political pendulum will swing the other way, as it always does, before any permanent damage occurs to the administrative state built over the last 100 years. Plus, flipping just two House seats next year gets us back to ESPN's Monday night impeachment schedule. Your thoughts? Well, that's true. Since FDR's, whatever it was, 4 or 5 terms, basically the rule is that the pendulum swings every 8 years, excepting something extraordinary. So 1952, Republicans, 1960, Democrats, 1968, Republicans, 1976, Democrats. And the biggest disturbance of that was the 12 years of Reagan and Bush. And we're now, Republicans are thinking about, you know, okay, Trump for the next 4 years and then 8 years of J.D. Vance. You can create the conditions in which people are willing to prolong the swinging of the pendulum. But also, as I said here, the Democrats are serious about changing all the boys into girls and all the girls into boys. And we have seen that just this week. And that's what I mean about doubling down on the loser stuff for the moment. For the moment, because they may eventually, they're ambitious, which on the whole, conservatives in general are not. So they may in the end create conditions in which over half the country is happy for all the girls to become boys. And you will then have people like David French explaining how it's a tribute to conservatism that all our little girls are now little boys and all our little boys are now little girls. Because you should never underestimate the willingness of these guys to turn themselves into a pretzel, you know, And that is that's I don't rule that out. I think you could create condition. The thing about it as well is that if you've got a two-party system, the one party here wants to keep you rattled all the time. There's always something going on, you know. So, okay, it's COVID. It's the Ukraine war. So, yeah, it's now safe to leave the house if you don't mind being nuked by Putin. You know, this is a very, it's not a normal pendulum swinging time because there's no normal politics in that sense. Dr. Roy from Montreal says, congratulations, Mark. I was praying for you to win. Man is a pompous ass. Any way to ask for court costs? We don't. Basically, the ball is in his sugar daddy's court right now. As I said, right now, the most he can get is $6,002. And he is going to have to pay, or his sugar daddy is going to have to pay, over $1 million once all these things have shaken out. So that... He and his sugar, maybe his sugar daddy will have a come to Jesus moment or maybe he won't. But at the moment, and given that it takes a year to get a ruling on any of these things. Well, I'll take one more for Margaret Hughes. Given what the judges' courts put President Trump through for 4 years or more, and you for the past zillion years, do you think President Trump will legislate to end what has clearly been warfare against anyone the deep state sees as a threat to their agenda? Or do you think that is probably too big an ask, even for Trump? Well, there's a difference between a land of laws and a land of legalisms. And pathetic sophistry, which is what we, as I said, by definition, coughing up $2 billion is not the proper matter for a temporary restraining order, because that $2 billion is going all over the map. And once it's now in any other country, $2 billion would be a lot of money. It's only because it's America with however many tens of trillions in the hole we are this minute, that it's not. But you have to have, basically, Robert's thing is this Trump has to force a constitutional crisis just to get Roberts to do his job. Because he says, oh, I don't want the high court dragged into controversy. Wait a minute. The only reason it's being dragged into controversy, you idiot, is because the district court judge in Dead Moose Junction thinks he can legislate for the entire nation from Maine to Hawaii. And he can why don't you just have a consequential, except, you know, one, two, three of these cases, and then announce that it's exceeding jurisdiction for judges to strike down the national policy of the United States government. Why not? It's killing its variations on this attitude. The judges are crap. I don't really mean that, actually, because, you know, when you actually go back and read some of the consequential decisions in American law, a lot of judges have always been crap. If you ever find yourself in court, if you ever reread some of the judicial decisions in my cases and then say to yourself, oh, I think, as Nancy Pelosi did over some Supreme Court judgment, or rather that it's like Moses handing down, or God handing down the tablets to Moses. These issues need to be forced. People have been ruined. You know, I talked about, you know, figures from the first Trump administration who were put through the ringer like this. You can't go anywhere. You can't go anywhere to be made whole, as the victim witness people say at your county courthouse. You can't go anywhere to be made whole. So something I would be in favour, if I'd known this is what it was going to be like, then in 2012, I would just have burned the courthouse down and fled jurisdiction. You know, it's a completely disgusting system. And people have to, at some point, people are going to have to, the great thing about, I learned this in my Canadian, when people said, people aren't going to put up with Stein and Ezra Levant trashing our beautiful, beloved human rights councils or whatever they were called. We had to go. I think it was Warren Kinsella who said that. I thought he might have had a point. But I realized the amount of effort you have to do just to drag all those normie people. You have to go nuclear just to drag them half an inch in the right direction. And people are going to have to get mad about this. You know, what's the point? What's the point of having a 2-year election campaign if the district court judge in Dead Moose Junction can strike down the platform that the chief executive of the United States campaigned on? It's complete rubbish. And people need to get mad. And I hope that, I hope, you know, Roberts, this whole thing, he excelled himself today. And people are, all these sort of respectable types like Jonathan Turley, are encouraged because four of the nine, if you exempt Roberts and Amy Phoney Barrett, have indicated that they're going to be interested in taking this case up again when it comes back next month or whatever. Time counts. This is the government of the United States. You can't put it on hold for abstruse legal questions that should never be raised. You, John Roberts, and four of your colleagues are going to have to craft some ruling that prevents the district court judge in Dead Moose Junction pulling this crap over and over again. That is going to do it. I've gone long, and I shouldn't have gone long, because I've lost, I apologise for my voice, but that's going to do it for today. Do stick with Stein Online, we appreciate that. Our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links is coming up, Laura Rosen Cohen. She's going to round up the internet for you as only she can. If you're still toying with the pros and cons of joining the Mark Stein Club, come on in, the water's fine. Stay safe. Stay free.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. Rights reserved.